Global Capital Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair and I'm the Frequent Issuer's Managing Editor.
And I'm John Hay, Corporate Finance and Sustainability Editor.
Now, coming up this week, we'll be talking about Scotland bonds. This is the result of Scotland's First Minister, Hamza Yousaf, who told his party conference this week that Scotland will be issuing its own bonds. And we'll be looking into the prospects and problems of a new sovereign issuer from the UK, or perhaps sub-sovereign issuer, at least for now, with our SSA editor, Addison Gong, and our People and Markets editor, John Crabb. But first, John, you're freshly returned from the IMF World Bank annual meetings, which were in Marrakesh last week and over the weekend. Now, that's a really interesting time to be in Marrakesh, given the recent earthquake in Morocco. The contents of those meetings tend to be around development finance and such, and also at a time just when Israel has gone to war with Hamas. What was the flavour of the discussion like at the meetings? What was sort of dominating the agenda?
Well, the surprising thing was that really neither the earthquake nor the Israel-Hamas war dominated the agenda. I think the first... Taking the earthquake first, it was remarkable how little apparent damage there was in the city of Marrakesh itself. I think the devastating effects were in the mountains, in villages, where there was undoubtedly, you know, severe loss of life and great damage to property. And some of the multilateral development banks there were offering aid. The European Investment Bank, for example, announced a 1 billion euro contribution to Morocco's 12 billion euro post-reconstruction programme. As for the war, this was obviously the dominating news story of the week for the whole world. But several people commented that they were surprised, you know, it wasn't on everybody's lips in the public discussions, in the panel sessions. The European Investment Bank president, Werner Hoyer, when we interviewed him, said he felt he had to keep bringing it up everywhere he went just to make sure people were talking about it. But this highlights, I suppose, one of the difficulties for multilateral development banks and the IMF and so on, which is that they can't respond very quickly to crises. They're not set up for that. This war, after all, is a political and military situation developing very quickly. And our story on the first day was really about how the international organisations were struggling to formulate responses.
OK, and then what about the topic of, well, the way the MDBs, the multilateral development banks, operate themselves? Because that's been a really big topic at this conference for the last couple of years, hasn't it?
Yes, I think the overriding most important issue that was really discussed in a meaningful way was reform of the multilateral development banks. And this has gone from a sort of niche area, really known by just a handful of academics and other experts, to the top of the agenda at the World Bank annual meetings. And that's because the G20 really is driving a reform agenda now, and particularly the US has got behind it. And the US is so influential as the largest shareholder in many of the MDBs. And Janet Yellen, the US Treasury Secretary, was there. She was pushing it very hard. We've got Ajay Banga, who's the new president of the World Bank, who this is his first annual meetings. He's also behind the agenda. So this is going to mean essentially a much more innovative and sort of on the front foot approach to balance sheet management, which should lead to balance sheet expansion at the MDBs. Lots more bond issuance, therefore, and things like hybrid capital, which is a sort of way for the MDBs to raise more capital that they can then leverage without going to their shareholders for a capital increase, which is a long, slow political process. And we did actually carry a couple of stories about hybrids. The World Bank Treasurer Jorge Familiar told us that they were getting enormous demand and interest from their shareholders in the private hybrid issues they're doing. And the EBRD told us that they plan to issue a hybrid, which we reported.
And of course, the banner transaction in this asset class, as we've talked about on the podcast before, will be the first hybrid from the African Development Bank. Do we have any sort of update on how that deal's going?
Well, it's very interesting. The African Development Bank has led the way among the top 10 or so MDBs that are AAA rated and well known in the bond market, it was the first to announce a sort of proper plan a whole year ago. The board signed it off the summer before last. It's been waiting and determined to get the best possible market reception. They began talking to investors in July. They formally announced the deal in September, but it has not appeared yet. And I think this inevitably does suggest that the demand is not quite as enthusiastic as they'd hoped. It's probably not that there isn't demand, but that the pricing the market wants is not quite as keen as the African Development Bank wants. And, you know, so this is really all eyes in the public sector bond market are on this at the moment to see whether the deal can come and get done.
It's an interesting point in the process. You wrote yesterday, John, an opinion piece for us, and you were sort of suggesting in that it would be a good idea for the African Development Bank just to get on, pay what was required and print the deal. But of course, the issue is, you know, ultimately this is public money and it must, yeah, must always, yeah, search for the keenest value, mustn't it?
Yeah, and obviously we don't know the book of demand. We don't know what investors are saying, how much appetite there is. We're outside the process, and also there has to be said a level at which this deal would not make sense financially for the African Development Bank, because they make a lot of loans to African governments at low rates. They don't have a lot of spread flowing through from these loans to pay high spread on a hybrid. Their normal capital from shareholders, they don't have to pay dividends on. So, it would be expensive. They've got to make sure it makes sense. But of course, it does give them extra capital that they can do a lot more development finance with. And that is incredibly valuable to the African Development Bank and to its shareholders, after all, who really want them to do more loans. So it's a difficult decision for them. I hope that the deal can come, because I think it really could, once it gets out there in the market, really could get things going. I think investors who are cautious about it at the beginning will get used to the asset class and sort of get behind it.
Well, as was the case with hybrids in the corporate world, the first transactions, yeah, must have taken a very long, yeah, had a very long gestation, but now, yeah, they're almost like, they're part of a sort of programmatic issuance almost.
That's right. Yeah, they're standard product.
I understand IMF reform was also quite high up the agenda in Marrakesh.
Yes. So the IMF, unlike the World Bank, it doesn't have shareholdings. It has something called quotas, where the different countries each have a percentage share of sort of financial influence and votes at the IMF. Now, the trouble with this is it's a zero-sum game. All the developing countries naturally want more say in the IMF. It's incredibly important to them. Those who have to go into IMF programs are really at the beck and call of the IMF. They have to sort of do what it says, basically, in order to get loans. And, it's a huge issue. You've got countries like China and India, which have grown enormously in power, economic heft and even in population since the last time the quotas were revised in 2010. Now, at that time, China's share grew, and that meant other countries had to give way. So you can only, percentage shares can only add up to 100%. So the US, Europe conceded, and so did some developing countries. Now, this time, the developing world wants a bigger share. That can only come by the US and Europe giving up power. And they're pretty reluctant to do it. So there's going to be some awkward discussions over the next few months until December, when the IMF is supposed to finish this review process. And it looks rather like, no one's going to be happy, basically.
Always the way. Mm.
So during the annual meetings, there's usually not much bond issuance by emerging market countries. For one reason, most of the finance ministers are at the annual meetings, and the investors. But this week, one could have expected the market to get going again normally. But of course, there's a terrible war going on in the Middle East. So, Ralph, how's that affected particularly Middle Eastern capital markets?
Well, eager listeners to the Global Capital podcast, and readers indeed of our website, will know that we predicted that there would be issuance in the Middle East this week, and there was. Now, it was an interesting dynamic, of course, because there's believed to be very little contagion from Israel to the Middle East and back again, because issuers there have very little to do with the other. Israeli businesses, on the whole, don't do an awful lot of business in the Middle East and vice versa. So that's why there was issuance expected. Now, the other reason why people expected Middle East issuance to happen was because there's a very developed investor base there, which of local investors, which helped separate it from the wider international buyer base that tends to be sort of thinking about emerging markets as a whole and the value of their investment portfolio as a whole. And of course, issuers in the Middle East are, on the whole, pretty well rated as far as the emerging markets go. And lo and behold, there was a deal, and quite a standout deal it was too. It was from Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, which is the country's sovereign wealth fund. And it brought its debut Sukuk deal to market. A Sukuk is, of course, an Islamic finance instrument equivalent to a bond in conventional markets.
So it's perhaps surprising that the PIF hasn't done a Sukuk before, isn't it? But that presumably helped it to go well.
Yes. The well, first of all, the Sukuk market seems to be perennially undersupplied. There's an awful lot of cash to be invested in the region in Islamic products, and supply is scarce. PIF hasn't done a Sukuk before, but of course what we have to remember is, as much as Saudi Arabia as a sovereign borrower and its sort of closely related state entities like the PIF are sort of, you know, big Middle East capital markets behemoths. Yeah, yes. PIF did a big $5.5 billion bond issue back in February, and I guess was obviously saving its bullets for this Sukuk to do its next slug of funding.
So how did it go?
Well, it's an interesting case study, really, especially in terms of how external factors, namely the war and, of course, rates in the dollar market, are affecting deal execution. Now, of course, we've already said that this is a benchmark sort of banner issuer for the Middle East capital markets. And so you would expect it to do a big deal and for it to attract an awful lot of orders. Indeed, before the deal, or while the deal was just getting going, the issuer told us that it was expecting something similar in size to that $5.5 billion bond that it did in February. Now, in book building, it amassed an absolutely huge order book of $24 billion. It was also able to tighten pricing, bringing the spread in against US Treasuries by 30 basis points on each of the 5 and 10 year tranches.
So a huge book, tight pricing, it sounds like a great deal for them.
Yeah, you would think so, but the devil is in the detail, as always, with these things. Now, only issued $3.5 billion. I say only. I mean, that's not a trivial amount. But the issuer opted in the end, it told us, to do a deal that would perform well in secondary markets, which means, in this instance, limiting the size and not pushing over aggressively on pricing. It succeeded in that aim. The bonds traded up on Thursday in the secondary market. But what that tells you, a $3.5 billion deal from a $24 billion book, there must have been quite a lot of sensitivity to the price in the order book, meaning that it didn't feel confident enough that it could achieve its aims with a $5.5 billion deal or something similar. Now, what we have to bear in mind is that this deal was priced on Wednesday of this week. That was the day when the Israel-Hamas war seemed to sort of take a step up a notch, really, and there were genuine fears of a spread to a more regional conflict. This was the day that the attack on the hospital in Gaza happened, and tensions, you know, were definitely high. The other interesting dynamic at play here, of course, and it's something that we pointed out in our coverage last week, was that regardless of the regional conflict, The bigger influence on emerging market bonds, especially in dollars, is, of course, US interest rates and US Treasury yields. And they sold off on Wednesday. They ended the week before at 4.6% of the 10-year US Treasury. On Wednesday, it touched 4.9% for the first year. Mm. That really would have concerned buyers about what they were buying.
Yeah, Francesca Young, our emerging markets editor, who wrote the story on this, has been very hot on this issue of the Treasury rates going up, and the moves are really astonishingly large.
Yeah.
Considering how far and how long rates have been rising, for it to go up 30 basis points in a week is, you know, pretty peculiar. But I think, you know, another aspect of PIF surely is that it's sort of one of the very best names in emerging markets, almost, isn't it? That's one of the sort of safest, easiest to place bonds. So what does this tell us about the likelihood of other issuance from the Middle East?
Yeah, well, the feeling now is that actually the window is closed all of a sudden to those borrowers. Obviously, for issuers of a caliber of the PIF and others of that ilk, they presumably would be able to get a deal done. But there are two problems now. The first is that investors will be skittish about that sort of sell-off in the US Treasury market. They may also have further concerns about the escalation of the Israel-Hamas conflict. And then, of course, on the issuer side, they care very much about how much they have to pay for this issuance. Mm-hmm. And they won't want to, for example, do a 10-year deal this at the end of this week, 30 basis points more expensive to them than they could have done it at the start of last week. So they will likely, it is thought, sit the market out for a while. I didn't get the sense from anyone. I don't think Francesca got the sense from anyone that there was any issuer urgently needing to come to the market. And of course, this will have, one would hope, the beneficial effect for them of strangling new issuance supply and therefore helping bring spreads back in.
Well, another issuer that's not likely to be issuing soon and that could be looking at a high cost of interest is Scotland. And we'll be hearing a little more in a moment about its plans for bonds.
Hello, John. Hello, Addison. Welcome to the Global Capital Podcast.
Hello, Ralph.
Hi, Ralph. Thanks for having me today.
So big news for the capital markets from Scotland this week. What did Hamza Youssef, the Scottish First Minister, actually say about Scotland bonds?
Yeah, sure. So he proposed this idea of issuing bonds from the Scottish government for the first time. He said the use of proceeds would help Scotland build better infrastructure and therefore increase people's quality of life. They have a bit of time, or they gave themselves a bit of time to work on this issuance by the end of the current parliament session, which I understand is in May 2026. So it's almost 3 years from now. So that's ample time for any plan, hopefully, to take off the ground. So we are looking at a modest-sized issuance, either by an annual basis or on an overall basis. It would be at £450 million pounds a year, equivalent up to $3 billion total. So this is a act that was enacted in 2016 that allowed them to borrow up to this limit. And obviously the numbers are now subject to inflation, or will rise with inflation. So that is the gist.
Okay, so that's a still statutory limit on the maximum they can issue. It's not the Scottish government's like plans for issuance. They're still quite unknown, aren't they?
Yeah, there's a limit, but from talking to market participants, the feeling we get is 450 million is already quite a small amount.
So he said the bonds were for housing and infrastructure and all sorts of goodly things such as that. I mean, do we think that's really what they're for, John?
Personally, I don't. I think it's fairly clear that the Scottish National Party is kind of pushing ahead with this to try and gain some political capital. It's had a pretty tough year. Nicola Sturgeon kind of and her husband got the party into some bother when they kind of been accused of embezzling quite a significant amount of money, and the kind of national sentiment towards independence has been waning somewhat, and it seems kind of like quite nice timing with it being the date that the Indy Ref 2 was meant to be, really, to kind of to make this announcement. And so yeah, for me it doesn't really seem like, you know, these numbers that you're talking about are actually going to have much of an impact on affordable housing across the country. It's more political posturing.
Yeah, I mean, Youssef said, didn't he, in his speech to the Scottish National Party conference, that by issuing these bonds, we will show the world not only that we are a country to invest in today, we will demonstrate the credibility to international markets that we will need when we become an independent country. We should also mention, for those who listen outside the UK, Nicola Sturgeon was, of course, Youssef's predecessor as leader of the SNP and as Scottish First Minister. So this is what, more of an attempt to revive the independence campaign, do we think?
Yeah, I'd say so. There was a, I think, if you look at the polls, kind of in the wake of Brexit, there was a big resurgence and lots of people kind of changed their minds about whether they backed independence, and lots of people who had maybe kind of not been so keen on the idea on kind of economic grounds maybe thought that all of the kind of the mess that had been made by the UK government after Brexit was maybe, you know, it was, we were kind of sitting in a pretty bad situation anyway, and nobody in Scotland, well, not nobody, but, you know, the vast majority of people in Scotland voted against Brexit. So it kind of really did change the political leanings. So, but that has been waning. And kind of as, you know, things kind of simmer down a bit after Brexit, kind of a lot of those people are beginning to think, do we really want to have to go through that again? So I'd say they kind of, they are facing a bit of trouble in Scotland, the SNP, and there's every chance that the Labour Party are going to make pretty big grounds in the next election. So I think, you know, it's pretty important that they got the timing right to try and make a statement here.
Yeah. So, Addison, one thing bond markets care about is detail and certainty. What do we, and, you know, frankly, pricing. Let's start with Scotland as a credit for now. What were people's opinions on how it will work as a credit and what sort of rating it might have? And how will investors view it?
I mean, so far, as in Scotland is still not an independent country yet, people will naturally view it as a sub-sovereign entity or regional kind of issuer, which would put it in line with the likes of, if we look across Europe, the likes of French regions, for example, Belgian regions, Spanish, the autonomous communities, as well as German lenders, so, and then the Canadian provinces, etc. So those will be the league, the same league that Scotland will be in. Rating wise, there isn't any certainty, as Scotland is not rated publicly by any of the agencies. But if we look back to the time when the Scottish bonds idea was first floated around independence, that would suggest some of the major agencies, I think Moody's being one of them, has suggested that Scotland will be rated 2 notches down from the UK, although now the UK has been downgraded because of various reasons over the years. But UK is currently a 3 AA- so that would indicate that Scotland could be single in the single A instead of double A bucket. But again, it's not a certainty. If it was rated at the sub-sovereign level, some of the sub-sovereigns across Europe are rated on par with the sovereign. So it's not to say that Scotland would definitely be rated lower than the UK, but it would be capped probably at the double A kind of double A minus kind of rank.
Well, a lower rating than the UK, that would suggest that a good sort of place to start would be that, especially as it's a debut borrower too, and wouldn't have any, be offering anything like the sort of liquidity in the gilt market, that the Scotland would trade at a premium to gilts. Are there any clues out there as to how much extra Scotland would have to pay?
Yeah, sure. We collect our data for the primary market monitor day in, day out. So data from that suggests that if we look at French and Belgian issuers, this year they are paying about like 30 to 45 basis point, that kind of range on top of the sovereign, even though some of these regional issuers are rated on par with the sovereign, so they are not notched down. If we look at the case of Spain, Spain was paying lower, about like 20 to 30 basis point, that kind of range. And German lender, because of the outperformance of bonds or the German government bonds this year, they're actually paying a higher spread of 60 to 70, that kind of range. to price their primary deals. And if we look away from Europe, for example, people mention the name of Quebec from Canada, the French speak region, French-speaking region, and they are about like 25 basis points or so in the dollar market, in the international market, compared to where the sovereign has priced. Now, if we look a bit closer to the UK, we have the Jersey and our men who have sold bonds in the last couple of years or so. Jersey came about 100 basis point over the UK, and LMN 60, and both are trading about like that in that kind of 70 basis point kind of range. So that would hopefully help give a bit of a little bit of an idea of where the Scotland may come. But although, like you said, Ralph, it's a new issuer, it's a considerably lower liquidity than other regional issuer that probably mentioned across Europe and in Canada. So arguably. And then not to mention there is some political risk associated with them. So like we can be looking at a higher or if not much higher spread.
And are there any examples from Scotland itself, John?
Well, there is one that was dug up by Bill Blaine, this who's a financial markets commentator. He knows about a transaction that took place in 2015 when the Scottish government gave its guarantee for some payments on hydroelectric power project. And this, he reckons, was priced at 250 to 300 basis points over gilts, which is an alarmingly widespread. Now, obviously, that's a private illiquid deal. No one knows the circumstances in detail. And it's not necessarily a guide to what would happen in the public market, but I think it is an interesting reference point.
Yeah, and I mean, quite aside from pricing, there are really some quite fundamental things to be ironed out here, aren't there? Because although we're talking about pre-independence issuance, by the sounds of it, eventually investors will be thinking ahead and thinking that if Scotland does become independent, then is it then issuing in a currency that it's not its own, that it doesn't have control of? That will be a risk factor for them to consider. And of course, the amount of debt that it takes on from the UK as part of any sort of economic or constitutional divorce will also have a bearing on how investors view it as a credit, won't it?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about Scotland compared with all these other regions is its political instability. If you're looking at any of the regions in Europe, with the exception of Catalonia, where there is an independence movement, you know, all these ones across Europe have a stable position in the country. So it's just a matter for investors of considering what is the extra credit risk of a smaller entity with sort of less power and a smaller economy. But the case of Scotland is completely different. This bond is being proposed specifically as a bridge to independence. In other words, as a bridge to Scotland becoming a completely different credit, not a region within the UK, but a different country that hasn't existed for 300 years as an independent state. So for investors to price that credit risk is, you know, remarkably difficult.
And so how likely do investors believe this will be in terms of coming to fruition, Addison?
I think it's probably, if I would say, again, when the idea was first brought up, I wasn't part of the conversation at the time, but I did feel a bit like, to me, that the boy who cried wolf situation, like we've been here before. Mm. And nothing came to fruition. And by the sound of it, people mostly interpret it as something that's a political posturing, a political distraction, rather than something that actually economically that makes sense. So from that standpoint, I'm not a political expert in any sense, but it just does sound like to me that people think there's a certain level of uncertainty about whether an issuance between now and 3 years, between now and May 2026, would indeed be sold. Sorry, I don't think most of the market believe that we are actually looking at a concrete plan to issue a bond. So there is a certain kind of a question mark on whether and how serious the government it is to indeed start issuing.
John, you've written in a previous life when you worked for one of our sister titles, IFLR, which is about finance and law and the intersection of those two things. You wrote extensively about what would happen in the case of Scottish independence in terms of that divorce bill that I spoke about earlier. And that won't be a straightforward process if it happens, will it? And that's something else that probably the market will be cognizant of and will have plenty to worry about.
Back in 2014, when this was kind of first being discussed by the Scottish National Party, they issued a report under the guise of the Sustainable Growth Commission, which they formed, which basically was trying to answer all the kind of economic questions that were, you know, going to come up in the case of kind of divorcing part of a country from another country. And one of the questions that it asked was kind of what the mechanism for Scotland to pay a reasonable share of servicing the net balance of the UK's debt and assets, which obviously, you know, would have a, you know, it would be due to pay. So they came up with this annual solidarity payment, which they kind of worked out would be about £5 billion at the time. Obviously, probably completely different now. So that was 0.7 GNP contribution for foreign aid and a further £1 billion for the shared services. So basically, they came up with this sum. But it's pretty complicated. They looked to examples like in Yugoslavia when the country broke up and they'd kind of had similar issues. So it's,
I'd say they had slightly worse issues than that.
But of course they had different issues, but much worse issues, but you know, they also had to deal with this. And everyone I spoke to at the time, it just, nobody really quite bought into this idea. And it just seems like with many of the issues you've just been discussing, there's more questions than answers and nobody really knows what would happen.
So does the SNP government have a reputation for financial competence?
To be honest, at the moment, the SNP doesn't really have a very good reputation for very much. I mean, they've been kind of de facto single party Scotland for several years, and purely based on the fact that the majority, or kind of around 50% of the country, has wanted independence. So they've been winning kind of by default of that, even though their governance hasn't been particularly good. For a pretty strong example is a scandal that's been kind of nicknamed the ferry fiasco, which they kind of have somehow managed to triple the cost of a couple of ferries that they were trying to develop with Caledonian McBrayne, the state-owned ferry operator. It went up to £360 million. They've got into massive debt and these ferries haven't really ever appeared. It's a complete disaster, essentially. And one of the kind of lasting legacies of ex-First Minister's Nicola Sturgeon's time, it's definitely safe to say that the SNP doesn't have a very good financial record, I would say.
But I think this story raises very interesting questions, doesn't it, about how the financial divorce could possibly be done. And as Bill Blaine pointed out, Scotland has 8% of the population. So on that basis, one might assume it took over 8% of the national debt of the UK now, or at least took responsibility for it in some way. But if you think about somehow carving out £200 billion worth of gilts out of the gilt market, it's an almost insane prospect, isn't it? In when you think about how sort of smoothly and calmly government bond markets normally work, I mean, it would be a sort of like a sort of serious accident.
So one suggestion, obviously, is to kind of transfer and for Scotland to take on a calculated proportion of the debt, as we discussed. But, you know, how to calculate that number is pretty difficult. When I was doing the research for this, it was one person said that, you know, with the question of where to draw the line, you know, you could do it by GDP, by population share, by government spending. But yeah, at the time he said, either way, it's going to be a mess. So I don't think that will have changed.
If you're interested in finding out more about what was discussed at the World Bank annual meetings this year, go to globalcapital.com and click on the Global Markets tab at the top left of the page. You'll find in-depth coverage from the meetings there. And be sure to follow us to keep track of Scotland's path to the bond market and, of course, all the latest from the world's capital markets. It only remains for me to thank John, and Addison for recording this edition with me, and thank you most of all, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll be back with more from the capital markets next week. So thank you for listening and goodbye.